I call this meeting of the Environment and Natural Resources Finance and Policy Committee to order. A quorum is present. Representative Vang, have you had a chance to look at the minutes, and would you make a motion for their approval?
Yes, Madam Chair. I move to approve the minutes for March 12, 2024.
Representative Vang moves the minutes for March 12th of 2024. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, say no, and the motion prevails. The minutes are approved. We have a very packed agenda today, so we're going to get right into House File 3550 with Representative Hansen. And would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair. I'd move that House File 3550 be placed on the General Register.
And Representative Hansen, I believe you have an A5 author's amendment. Would you like to move the amendment and explain it?
Yes, Madam Chair. The A5 amendment, members, this is a bill that was referred back to our committee. We are taking out a fiscal portion that necessitated it going to Ways and Means by removing that. And then also, when the bill was here, there was provisions where there were suggestions from the counties, and we are incorporating those changes. You'll see on subdivision 10 on page 28. So that is the A5 amendment, and I move the A5 amendment and ask for your support.
Representative Hansen moves the A5 amendment to get the bill in the form he would like. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed, no. The motion prevails. The A5 amendment is adopted. Representative Hansen, to your bill as amended.
And Madam Chair, I have the Executive Director for the Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources, John Jashke, to talk about how the changes that were made to incorporate, and then that's a quick update of the input that we received from the last, from when it was here last, and making those changes. So.
Welcome back to the committee, Director Jashke. Please state your name for the record, and then help us out with this bill.
Yeah, Madam Chair, thank you, and members. As Representative Hansen noted, this bill last was heard here. It was referred and it came back. First section being removed as a fiscal matter, that was the reason for the bill coming back. The other items are technical changes that address really just making sure the bill is written in the proper fashion. The provision on line 1.5 to 1.8 is making sure that we're clear about the professional engineering standards are in a state statute already for licensure, so referring directly to that statute is important. The language on lines 1.12 through 1.14 is language that we worked on with the counties and watershed districts to make sure there's enough process there for them to understand and how that would work between the state review of their local ordinance and rule. And the other items are just cleanup provisions. The other one that Representative Hansen alluded to was on line 1.19 and 1.20. They were reinstating a provision that had been deleted because it was also in federal authorities that the state is now taking on. But this is, still worthwhile to remain in state statute in case the feds change. So, Madam Chair, that was my overview.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify on this bill? Questions from members? Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the testifier, one of the letters in support of the bill talks about more public engagement with the watershed planning process. Can you go a little bit into that alteration?
Sure.
Director Jashke.
Madam Chair and Representative Purcell, the watershed, there's a couple different ways to define watershed. Watershed districts, the language in this bill through Chapter 103D is being updated to make sure there's more consistent processes for project decisions and petitions. There's also some cross-links to other statutes that have been passed since then, the Metropolitan Surface Water Management Act and the One Watershed, One Planning Authority. I think all of those are being left as is, other than the case of the engineering provision, which is about engineers being designated to carry out projects on behalf of the Watershed Board.
Representative Purcell. Representative Heintzman.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm trying to just confirm where the SWCDs and watershed districts are at if they support this bill, and I'm seeing now there's paperwork here, so I apologize.
Further discussion to the bill. Representative Hansen to close.
And it might be appropriate to thank the Soil and Water Conservation Districts. That is their day at the Capitol today. I'm assuming there are, they're here. So thank you for the work that they do in getting conservation in the ground. I'd ask for your support for House File 3550 as amended.
Representative Hansen renews his motion that House File 3550 as amended be placed on the general register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, say no. The motion prevails. The next bill on our agenda is House File 4844 from Representative Hansen. Representative Hansen, when you're ready, would you like to move this bill?
Yes, I would move House File 4844. This is the bill relating to feral hogs and fur farms. I would move that it be referred to the Agriculture, Finance, and Policy Committee.
And Representative Hansen, I believe you have an A1 author's amendment. Would you also like to move the amendment and explain it?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move the A1 amendment. What this does is it removes a provision that would require it go to the Judiciary Committee. This would go to the Finance, to the Ag Finance Committee instead from here. So I'd move the A1 amendment.
Representative Hansen moves the A1 amendment to get the bill in the form he would like. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, say no. The motion prevails. The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Hansen, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members, you may remember last year we had a report that we tasked the DNR to work with the other agencies looking at our existing laws relating to authorities and responsibilities for feral hogs. We had the discussion about Eurasian wild boar coming across the border from the north and also some domestic release of hogs. In addition, with mink farms and just some very old law and what happens with regulation of those. So the DNR, I will give credit to them for having a public process where they had a lot of public engagement and developed a report which was provided to us in January, and these are the recommendations from that report. And so I have Mr. Rivers here from the Department of Natural Resources and Mr. Mensick from the Pork Producers Association to testify on the bill.
Yes. Welcome to the committee. Mr. Rivers, please state your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Pat Rivers. I'm the Deputy Director for the Division of Fish and Wildlife at the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. As Representative Hansen said, this is a result of a recommendation report that the DNR published this past January, and we support the bill. We look forward to working with the author on how this bill goes forward.
Thank you, Director Rivers. Next on my list is Dave Mensick from the Minnesota Pork Producers Association. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and title for the record and proceed with your testimony.
David Mensick, member of the Minnesota Pork Producers. Good afternoon, Chair and members of the committee. I'm David Mensick here on behalf of the Minnesota Pork Producers Association. I'm a pig farmer from Preston, Minnesota, where I farm with my wife, our son, and his family. I'll be brief in my comments as we appreciate Representative Hansen's work to strengthen language addressing feral swine here in Minnesota. We are committed to working with the author to ensure we have a strong direction from the bill to prevent feral swine from becoming an issue in Minnesota. I'm grateful Minnesota has not had an established feral swine population. Feral or loose swine are known to carry disease, can be aggressive and destructive to crops and the landscape, and are notoriously difficult to manage if not dealt with swiftly. Keeping my pigs healthy is a top priority. Loose or feral swine are a threat to the health and safety of domestic pigs. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and we look forward to continuing to work with Representative Hansen on this bill as it moves forward.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify on this bill? Question from members. Representative Burkle.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Hansen, for the bill. As you know, I've shared pictures with you of what's happening up in Kitson County. And I'm curious if there's going to be any, I didn't see anything about eradication efforts, or is there going to be any conversation about what we're going to do moving forward if these swine from the north move in droves.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I think that's a discussion we can have in the Ag Committee, you know, and this bill is going to go forward. We do have a couple provisions where there's dot, dot, dot. We're hoping to see what the what targets we get, and I think talking with Chair Vang to what targets are in agriculture and where that responsibility would be if, you know, and maybe you can share with the committee the photo of the of the Eurasian boar in Kitson County, you know, so they're here. And how do we deal with that? And so I think this starts this conversation. Hopefully we can get a target somewhere that we can use to make sure that we're able to respond to that crossing, but also to make sure that the program is implemented well for the future.
Representative Burkle.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm curious, beyond the feral swine part of it, on the domestic side, will this affect all sizes of farms as far as hogs that are released? We're talking any size?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And that's, as this goes to the Ag Committee, that is part of what we wanted in talking with the pork producers. They wanted to clarify where there is that responsible line. And then also to further define, you may have an inadvertent release versus a persistent problem that somebody just continually has the hogs out.
Right.
So that, we hope to work on that when we get to the Ag Committee and define those changes, because there are differences between them. So,
Representative Burkle.
I'm good. Thank you.
Great. Further discussion from members? Representative Heinzman.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hansen, could you talk a little bit about the changes to the fur farm statute over existing law that is addressed in the bill?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The existing fur farm, we have very old law. And I believe when we looked at this last year, it was a $2 or a $5 voluntary fee for inspecting fur farms. And what we probably remember of 20 or 30 years ago of fur farms with large fur farms essentially don't exist. It's probably more of a hobby situation. So the same authority, the question though is, who does respond and do that enforcement for them? That public input process, most people think the DNR is responding to this, you know, whether it's a fur farm or the feral hogs. So if that's where we have the general public thinking that's where that enforcement is, they're still going to be, there's going to be responsibilities with the Board of Animal Health. And with both issues, whether it's the hogs or whether it's with the mink, if there is disease, that testing, that response has to be there so we know what happens. For example, I'll go back to the hog. What if you call in a hog and then the DNR comes and shoots that, and who's going to test that? Is going to find out, does it have pseudorabies? Does it have African swine fever? The same type of thing we need to make sure is there. For the, we haven't got a fiscal note yet on this bill, you know, that's part of it. How do we check that particular response? I think the estimate, if I didn't say it before, is maybe 6 locations now across the whole state.
Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to confirm, or before we move on, maybe, are there any other substantial changes? It's a pretty kind of a lengthy discussion, but on a smaller bill, but I just want to just make sure before we move on and hear the next bill.
Representative Hansen.
I think the most substantial change is defining these issues of the domestic hogs that go wild versus feral hogs that may be a species that is hybrid and responding to those. And with the domestic hogs having that, I mean, I think we're into new territory there, and we're trying to clarify that so it's as clean as can be for those domestic hogs versus the species that, like what Representative Burkle was saying, that's coming in. And we want to make sure that somebody isn't inadvertently or purposely bringing in something, hey, I'd like to have a Eurasian wild boar in my back 40, and then that there's a consequence in that. People need to know, no matter how cute they think it is, may have a big consequence and it's prohibited.
Any final discussion to the bill? Representative Hansen, closing comments.
This is, again, I'd commend the DNR for their work on public engagement involving. I think it's made a stronger report. There's a lot here. It does need to go to the Ag Committee, and there will be a fiscal cost, and we hopefully will have some money available to make this happen. So I would ask your support for House File 4844 as amended and move it to the Ag Committee.
Representative Hansen renews his motion that House File 4844 as amended be re-referred to the Agriculture, Finance, and Policy Committee. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, say no. The motion prevails. The next bill on our agenda is House File 4410. Representative Hansen, would you like to move your bill?
I would move House File 4410. And that
Judiciary, I believe.
Is going to the Judiciary Committee.
And Representative Hansen, I believe you have the A3 author's amendment. Would you like to move the A3 and explain it?
Madam Chair, I would move the A3 author's amendment. Some of the provisions in here clarify. This is a PCA agency bill, and we felt there needed to be some clarification relating to some of the funds and clarifying the civil penalties. There are is a provision in here I think there may be some concerns about, I had included that based on the recommendation from Representative Lee, so I would defer to him on that particular point.
Representative Hansen moves the A3 amendment to get the bill in the form he would like. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, say no. The motion prevails. The A3 amendment is adopted. Representative Hansen, to your bill as amended.
And Madam Chair, I'd bring forward Tom Johnson with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Johnson. Please say your name and title for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Tom Johnson, Government Relations Director for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Want to thank you, Chair Hansen, for bringing forward this bill. This is the House File 4410. The underlying bill is language proposed by the MPCA. The agency has brought forward versions of this language over the years. It's most notably in 2020 and 2021 after enforcement actions regarding the Water Grumman facility in the White Bear Lake area. After that enforcement action and others of concern, legislators, including several on this committee and also in the other body, have asked the agency to identify barriers to our enforcement process and any new tools that are needed to ensure the protection of the environment and of communities across Minnesota. So this bill does both of those things, Madam Chair. You'll see areas of the bill where we see clarity needed to remove ambiguity, such as line 2.1 under the underlying bill that the agency already has these authorities to adopt, reissue, modify, deny, enter into, enforce all of these actions related to preventing and controlling and abating water pollution. The word reopen was not in there, so we wanted to add that for clarity. You'll see other areas where we're making clear expectations that we believe already exist in the intent of the law, such as Section 5 and 6. Say Section 5 in the underlying bill, I believe it's Section 6 as amended, where we want to make it clear that if a facility or a person or an entity does not obtain a permit when they should have, they would still need to comply by the same types of requirements that would be in the permit if they had obtained that permit. So just making sure that there's not an incentive to not obtain a permit for an entity over a business that is trying to do the right thing and get their permit. And then, of course, there are new and expanded tools here to ensure the public safety and the protection of the environment. And that you'll see that in Section 9 or Section 10 is amended, where we're seeking additional emergency powers for those extreme situations where there are severe noncompliance, falsification of records, evidence of danger to the health or welfare of people, the state, these types of very extreme scenarios that we want to ensure we have robust powers to make sure there's an immediate remedy. Finally, I just want to reiterate my thanks to Chair Hansen for bringing the bill forward. The amendment language, we are still reviewing that. Most of those technical corrections in the bill do seem like good corrections and improvement to the language, so I want to thank the chair for that. This piece about on line 2.15 and 2.16 does seem to provide any person the ability to bring civil action in the name of the state, and we are still reviewing that with our legal team, and would expect the Attorney General would want to also review that language, but we're happy to continue to work with the bill author and the committee moving forward on that. So thank you, Madam Chair. Happy to stand for questions. We also have agency experts here.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Next on my list of testifiers is Tony Quillis, Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Welcome back to the committee, Mr. Quillis. Please state your name and title for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Tony Quillis. I'm the Director of Environmental Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Thank you for the opportunity to make a couple of comments on House File 410. I'd like to come at this from a perspective of a permit holder, because this affects all permits throughout the state of Minnesota, including air, water, hazardous waste, and not just businesses, but also cities and counties that obtain permits from the Pollution Control Agency. Madam Chair and members of the committee, the first section I'd like to draw your attention to is 4.15 to 4.24, and it shows up again on 7.28. It talks about a negotiated agreement with the state agency for and includes oversight costs exceeding $25,000. There is no stop on that, so essentially it is a blank check for the agency with no recourse or appeal for the permittee to have any say on the inspection, sampling, monitoring, or risk assessments. So the concern there is, instead of working into a negotiated agreement with the agency, that most people will go to litigation, and this will cost more time and cost to the agency as well as to the permittee. On sections 2 and 3 of the bill, where it allows for cease performance and cease of operation, I want to draw your attention to section 9, where under emergency powers, where right now the commissioner, if there is an imminent and substantial danger to the health, welfare of the people of the state or any of them as a result of the pollution of air, land, or water, by emergency order may direct immediate discontinuance of abatement of the pollution without notice, without a public hearing. So I think that those two provisions that are included in sections 2 and 3 are already covered under the emergency powers of the commissioner. Staying on section 9, finally, Madam Chair and members, is under the acts of concern under section 2. It talks about history of compliant, non-compliance, and chronic and substantial. And those are important terms and need to be broad. They're too broad and need to be further clarified, because if you look down into subdivision B underneath it, that's what sends you into being able to have your permit suspended, revoked, or cease operations. So is history of compliance, is that clerical or paper, or is that an emissions violation? And so it's, if you're a city and your wastewater treatment operator has gone through and possibly had missed 3 months, is that chronic? And then that leads you into suspension or revoke, having your permit revoked. So I just think those definitions need to be clarified a little bit more, because you can have a suspension or revoke of a permit even regardless of presence of imminent and substantial danger. If that's not there, the agency could still come in and suspend or revoke a permit for a simple paper violation, is how I interpret that, Madam Chair. And then in regards to the A3 amendment, I'd like to echo Mr. Johnson's comments about we'd like to go through and look at a little bit longer on the ability of citizens to now go through and take action against the agencies. I think that the judiciary, my comments would probably be better fit for the Judiciary Committee, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Quillis. Is there anyone in Representative Wislegar, do you have a question on the bill or a question for Mr. Quillis?
I would like those questions answered by the department.
We'll go to that afterwards. Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify for or against the bill? Looks like Mr. Johnson is approaching the table. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and title and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Craig Johnson with the League of Minnesota Cities. My comments can be very brief because they've already been mentioned by both the agency and the Chamber of Commerce. The A3 amendment is the place that drew our attention to this. The core of the bill, we felt we could work with the agency on how they implemented it into their enforcement arrangements over time and come back if there were problems with that. But making a change so that any individual person can act on behalf of the state of Minnesota and bring litigation against a permit holder does not seem like a viable way for us to move forward with how enforcement of environmental laws is managed by our state. So thank you very much, and we look forward to working with the chair and the other folks involved with this amendment as it moves forward.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we will go to member questions and start with Representative Wislegar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I would like the department to answer Tony or Mr. Quillis's questions, and I do agree with the last testifier that, a whole lot of people, that's what they use the courts for, sue, delay to kill projects, and we can't afford to be killing any more projects.
Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Let me see if I can remember all of them. But on line 4.15 of the underlying bill, this section where I believe Mr. Quillis was referring to the costs that the agency could be reimbursed for, there's a very narrow group of activities here that the agency could recoup costs for. So that would be this inspection, sampling, monitoring, modeling, risk assessment, permit writing, engineering review, economic analysis and review, and it would only be related to the oversight costs that are incurred associated with implementing a negotiated agreement that is already final. So we're talking about a stipulation agreement, a settlement, a schedule of compliance that the agency has already decided on the terms with the regulated party on, and the regulated party is not complying with those terms that we have decided and agreed upon. And so the idea behind this language was not to write a blank check for the agency, but in situations where we have already agreed to terms of an enforcement action, and those terms are then being violated again, and the agency is expending additional resources to ensure compliance with those agreed upon terms, those are the situations where we're looking to be reimbursed for those. And $25,000 would be the floor that we think is appropriate, so not just every single enforcement action, but for significant enforcement actions. Thank you, Madam Chair. Continuing on with other questions posed by Mr. Quillis, I believe going into the emergency powers was the other main section. In this area, the agency again is looking at history of noncompliance with schedules of compliance or terms of stipulation agreement. This is on line 9.4. So while I understand that the ambiguity there is of concern to Mr. Quillis, we are ensuring that this is really a history of noncompliance again with those already agreed upon terms that we've decided with the regulated party. We're open to defining more items in this bill, Representative Wislegar or with the author to work on those if there are clarifications needed, but overall we feel like this is very scoped to those specific situations.
Representative Wislegar, any further questions?
No, thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair. Excuse me. And Chair Hansen, thank you for the bill. I just have a question. The testifier mentioned water gremlin, I believe, at the beginning of the testimony. And I'm looking at this emergency powers provisions, and authority under this paragraph has evidence of any of the following. At what point in time do you think that one of these would have triggered that authority for water gremlin over the 19 years or whatever we knew of that pollution?
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, thank you. So the enforcement actions related to Water Gremlin were before my time at the agency. We're happy to follow up with you with more specifics related to that. However, I would say there were certainly some areas of the permit where we were aware of issues, and then there was a much more substantial issue that we then investigated and followed up on and resulted in one of the largest enforcement actions that the agency has ever brought forward. So I would say there's two distinct pieces there, but we're happy to follow up with you with more details.
Representative Hansen, did you have anything to add?
And I think we can go through and develop the scenario of how this would apply for that particular situation. Absolutely. And get back to Representative
Representative Finke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would appreciate that, because I do want to know that we can't just do this in hindsight, right? We have to actually imagine that this can proactively stop something like that from happening. So I think it would be useful to have an analysis of that.
I think that would be helpful. Mr. Johnson, any?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I was just saying that these specific situations were laid out in hindsight to the work that was done with Water Gremlin and other, again, enforcement issues of concern. So
I think the whole committee would benefit from that information.
Will do.
Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm glad you're still at the desk there, Mr. Johnson. I did want to go back to line 4.19, which I think you were attempting to address a question that Mr. Quillis posed about some concern relative to oversight costs may include. And if I heard correctly, I believe your answer suggested that the scope there of those that are impacted is very narrow. Now, if I misheard, I apologize. But if I'm reading line 4.19 correctly, it says, in addition to those items you read, but are not limited to. Am I misreading the language? Because if it's those items in the narrow scope you suggested, but yet right there immediately before is are not limited to, it sure does sound like the scope is much wider than you're suggesting in your testimony today.
Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and yes, thank you, Representative Heintzman. I think what I was referring to is that we have carved out these legal and litigation costs, so we have tried to scope it to actions that are related to our enforcement work and not our legal and litigation costs. So I apologize if that was misleading at all, but really we're, yes, any of these enforcement activities, including but not limited to these items, but not our, we've been very careful to carve out these legal and litigation costs.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. All right, then moving on, and I think Representative Lizegard wanted to get to this, and I'm not sure that it was addressed necessarily here. Again, if I missed it, I apologize. But I think the question was suggesting or asking or referencing those that may be on 7.5 through that whole section in subdivision 9, there are those that could, in a wastewater facility, you know, miss 3 months of paperwork and could potentially, at least if I'm reading this correctly, line 7.7 through 7.8, the person or facility is subject to liability and penalties, including criminal liability. So if I could have you expand on that a little bit, it does appear the bill has some problems here, some clunkers, and hopefully we can work these details out or abandon the bill completely. But if you could address that, I would appreciate it.
Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So in, I believe Mr. Quillis was looking at Section 9, but I will also look at Subdivision 9 here under on line 7.3. So I'm not aware of any wastewater facility that has failed to obtain their permit to operate a wastewater plant. I mean, those types of situations, I think it's very clear that a facility is, that an owner and operator or a municipality is looking to construct a facility. It's very clear that they're almost always, from my understanding, approaching the agency, working through and getting their permits, and there hasn't been an issue. I think this is very much intended to look at a situation and evening the playing field so that the types of requirements within a permit would be applicable to an entity whether they had obtained that permit as they were supposed to or whether they failed to obtain that permit. So they're looking at the same types of requirements either way.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just finally, a comment. Representative Finke was mentioning a specific compliance issue with a business. I think it was Water Gremlin. And I would just mention that the legislative auditor, and you may already be aware of this, so I apologize if it is something you've already been tracking, but for those that maybe aren't, the legislative auditor developed a very thorough report. And quite honestly, a lot of existing statute was not followed in that scenario, and there's been a lot of conversations about how, unfortunately, MPCA had a lot of problems and missed the ball, and there were some opportunities that were missed. So I just wanted to quickly mention that in case anybody's interested. Thank you.
Any further discussion from members? Well, Representative Hansen, any closing comments?
This bill continues to be worked on. It'll go to Judiciary Committee if it passes here. And lines on the again on the A3 amendment relating to sections 2.15 and 2.16. People have concerns about that. They should talk with Representative Lee. So I would renew my motion that the House file 4410 as amended be re-referred to the Judiciary Committee.
Representative Hansen renews his motion that House File 4410, as amended, be re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, say no. The motion prevails. Representative Hansen and I are going to swap seats.
Sorry, Representative Jordan, for leaving a pile of paper there, but I've got to come back.
Mr. Chair, I apologize for leaving a pile of paper at your seat.
House File 4028, Representative Jordan, Metropolitan Council, Environmental and Public Health Considerations. Representative Jordan, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move that House File 4028 be re-referred to the State and Local Government Committee.
And we have a lot of testifiers, so we're going to limit the testifiers to 2 minutes. Mr. Strohmeyer is going to be sharp on the clock. When we hit 2 minutes, I will tap the gavel. So Representative Jordan, to your bill.
Thank you, Chair Hansen and members. I'm here to present House File 4028, a bill to clarify which forms of environmental review on city comprehensive plans are most protective of our environment and prevents cities from frivolous litigation that sets back our cities from achieving their environmental and housing goals. Comp plans are required by the Met Council to ensure cities are planning for the future. Will they have enough housing and transportation options for future and current residents? How should stormwater and wastewater be addressed in the future? What are our future traffic patterns? City comp plans do not say we must build X project at Y intersection or account for individual projects. Individual projects then undergo environmental review. House File 4028 is necessitated because a group of plaintiffs sued the City of Minneapolis to block what is known as the 2040 plan. The Metropolitan Land Planning Act requires municipalities in the Twin Cities area to provide the Metropolitan Council, or Met Council, with an updated comprehensive plan every 10 years. The comp plan must be consistent with the Met Council's Regional Development Guide, Thrive MSP 2040, that sets the direction for the region's growth and development. Minneapolis's plan was unique because the city updated its zoning principles to allow for more density. The city could solve two problems at once with this plan. It reduces its carbon footprint and provides more housing, both things we as the City of Minneapolis desperately need to do. Unfortunately, a group of plaintiffs sued, and because of ambiguity in our state statute, these plaintiffs have prevailed. The city has been forced to halt projects that underwent environmental review and would have provided much-needed affordable housing because of their lawsuit. House File 4028 does not change zoning in the state. It does not amend the Minnesota Environmental Rights Act. It simply prevents cities from having to undertake the fraught legal hoops my city has had to jump through to have a plan that is in compliance with the Metropolitan Land Planning Act. The plaintiff sued Minneapolis under this loophole and has forced taxpayers in Minneapolis to pay. The next city they sue to block comp plans will certainly have a smaller tax base and will be much less able to defend themselves if we do not provide clarity to this law. This bill not only provides this clarity our cities are asking for, but also makes Minnesota law more protective of the environment with legislative findings to combat climate change and urban sprawl. This bill is supported by many environmental organizations, including the Sierra Club North Star Chapter, the Minnesota Environmental Partnership, the Land Stewardship Project, Health Professionals for a Healthy Climate, MN350, Clean Water Action, the Pollinator Friendly Alliance, Resilient Cities and Communities, the Alliance for Sustainability, Bicycle Alliance of Minnesota, Minnesota Interfaith Power and Light, Move Minnesota. It is also supported by many planning and municipal organizations, both the Minnesota and National Chapter of the American Planning Association, the League of Minnesota Cities, the Association of Metropolitan Municipalities, the City of Minneapolis, Minneapolis Public Housing Authority, and Minneapolis Public Schools. It is also supported by housing organizations such as Twin Cities Housing Alliance, Beacon Interfaith Housing Collaborative, Neighbors for More Neighbors, and Isaiah. It's also supported by labor organizations such as the Minneapolis Building and Construction Trades Council and SEIU. And with that, Mr. Chair, I think we should go to some testimony.
First up, Peter Wagenius, Sierra Club North Star Chapter, then Jack Perry, environmental lawyer. When you come, please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Peter Wagenius, Legislative Director with Sierra Club. I've submitted a letter from 12 environmental organizations in support of this bill, as well as some slides you'll see beginning with this one. Our support is grounded in research about how city populations relate to the environment. Cities in our metro area, cities that lost population in post-war decades, have now been restoring their populations in the last two decades by adding housing units. Despite all this recent growth, at least 11 cities, and they're mapped, are still underneath their previous peak populations. They should not be prevented from making further progress and by allowing new housing. When they are able to do so, those cities are also helping to reduce climate pollution. The number one source of climate emissions is transportation, and our land use policies force more people to drive longer and longer distances. MnDOT ranked land use reform as the most impactful policy available on reducing vehicle miles traveled. That's just one of several reasons why how we grow makes a huge impact on how much we collectively pollute. This is not new information. We've known that destroying more natural and undeveloped lands is hugely detrimental. We've known that per capita geographic distribution of carbon dioxide has been mapped as far back as 15 years ago. More recently, in 2022, the New York Times published maps of climate emissions. I included in the slides a close view of the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. To illustrate the importance of this bill, please compare that map to the previous map, showing those 11 cities collectively 126,000 people underneath their previous peak populations. It's far better for the climate to allow those cities to restore their population than to destroy farmland and natural spaces to create new housing for the same 126,000 people. This litigation has gone on far too long without resolution. It now threatens cities across the metro area. The legislature needs to provide clarity on comp plans in a way that is grounded in both the reality of climate emissions, where they come from, and how comp plans work. We can do that and protect MIRA. This legislation does both, and we are happy to support it.
Thank you. Jack Perry, environmental lawyer. Then next up, Nick Erickson, Housing First Minnesota. Welcome. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Jack Perry from the Taft Law Firm, and I am the lawyer who filed the non-frivolous lawsuit, at least according to the Minnesota Supreme Court, that ruled 7-0 in our favor. But I'm here to raise two issues with the bill and to have one proposal. The first issue with the bill is that it presupposes that you cannot have increased residential density and an environmental review. That is demonstrably proven false by Seattle's 2017 EIS for their 70,000 new homes, and by the City of Moorhead's 2018 series of environmental reviews for their comp plan of the same size. The second issue I have is that the legislation presupposes that there's no reason to do an environmental review. The problem is that the city of Minneapolis, before this all started, when we were asking them to do environmental review, not to delay, but to do it for environmental reasons back in 2017-18, the president of the city council admitted, and it's an article by Susan Dew, that if they had to do environmental review, it wouldn't survive. Now, it doesn't mean it wouldn't survive environmental review. It means they would have to plan for all the impacts for the authorization as a matter of law, according to the Supreme Court, of nearly 150,000 new homes. And you don't need to take the word of a lawyer. Instead, Susan Dew interviewed the people in charge of the environmental review in Seattle, 2017, and the people in Moorhead in 2018, and what they say, it was beneficial, period. My suggestion to you is, I'll date myself, but this situation is we have an immense need for increased residential density, no question about it. We also have a duty as stewards of the environment to protect the environment. And what we did in 1989, what this group did was, if I can finish the thought, Mr. Chair, is you authorized a generic EIS for the swine industry to address the situation that was going on there. And that's what I suggest you do with this here to address the need for residential density and environmental review. Thank you.
Thank you. Nick Erickson, Housing First Minnesota, then Nakima Levy Armstrong, North Minneapolis resident and civil rights attorney. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Nick Erickson. I represent Housing First Minnesota. Our members build the communities and places that we all call home. Housing First Minnesota is pleased to stand with the Sierra Club, League of Minnesota Cities, American Planning Association on this bill because it's needed. In our housing market today in Minnesota, we are 106,000 housing units short. That's homes, apartments, and condos. We will never be able to address this housing shortage when we have tools and systems that reward environmental NIMBYism to block our housing in our communities. And if it's not environmental review, it's going to be a traffic study. These reviews are used as tools to block needed housing because residents are fearful of change. And we have a significant housing shortage in Minnesota. This is why Housing First Minnesota has joined this broad coalition, asking you to support these, because these projects in Minnesota, when they're built, are built in compliance with state and federal environmental regulations related to stormwater, energy conservation. We build the most energy efficient homes in the country. These reviews should not be used as a pretext for NIMBYism to block needed housing in our communities. Thank you.
Thank you. Nakima Levy Armstrong, North Minneapolis resident and civil rights attorney, then Peggy Sue Imlihi Bean, Minnesota chapter of American Planning Association. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair and members of the committee. I'm here to provide testimony in opposition to House File 4028. My name is Nakima Levy Armstrong. I'm a civil rights attorney, former law professor, and community leader who resides in North Minneapolis. I also serve as co-counsel for plaintiffs in the environmental law case called Smart Growth versus the City of Minneapolis. Our purpose in filing a lawsuit on behalf of Smart Growth, comprised of Minneapolis residents, was to ensure that the City of Minneapolis was compliant with MERA, the Minnesota Environmental Rights Act, in its implementation of the 2040 plan. I provided written testimony on a similar bill introduced during the last legislative session. This current bill is no less of a threat to MERA than last year's bill. It guts the rights of over half of Minnesotans. Governmental bodies such as the City of Minneapolis must be held to the standard of following environmental laws regarding development. So much is at stake when governments are allowed to jeopardize the health, safety, and quality of life of individuals, children, families, and communities by failing to follow environmental laws. I have significant concerns regarding whether this bill will have the unintended consequence of undermining the applicability of environmental laws towards governmental bodies such as the City of Minneapolis, which had a duty to ensure compliance with MERA and MEPA laws before beginning implementation of its 2040 plan. Again, governments need to be held to the standard of following environmental laws, and the best time for that to occur is during the development phase of a plan such as 2040. Before a plan is implemented is the only time to properly assess and prevent cumulative harm from comprehensive plans. Only a government can be held responsible for cumulative harm. Plus, the Supreme Court in 2021 and the Court of Appeals in 2022 have both agreed that such plans have environmental consequences, and the best, if not the only time to address them is before they are implemented. It's important to note that during our 5 years plus of trying this case, we prevailed at every level of judicial review, including a unanimous decision by the Minnesota Supreme Court. Another reason why enforcement of compliance with environmental laws by the government is so important is the disparate impact that environmental injustices have on people of color and low-income people. If I can just wrap up, according to a 2020 report by the Princeton Student Climate Initiative, communities of color are disproportionately victimized by environmental hazards and are far more likely to live in areas with heavy pollution. People of color are more likely to die of environmental causes, and more than half of the people who live close to hazardous waste are people of color. We know that we're disproportionately impacted when governmental bodies are allowed to not comply with environmental laws. MIRA is a civil rights bill for our environment. It is not something that should be weakened based upon the actions of the city of Minneapolis. Thank you so much for your time and attention today.
Thank you, Sue Imhe Bean, Minnesota Chapter of American Planning Association, then Becca Ahrens, Minneapolis resident and environmental advocate.
Great. Well, thank you, Representative Jordan, Chair Hansen, and members of the committee for the opportunity to testify. I'm Peggy Sue Imhe Bean. I am the president of the Minnesota Chapter for the American Planning Association. We are part of a larger national organization and represent 900 planners and planning commissioners across the state of Minnesota. Good planning works to ensure that people of all walks of life can meet their daily needs in the places where they choose to live. It also works to preserve and protect natural and agricultural land to grow food, protect water and resources, and provide space for outdoor recreation. To do this, planners work to design for neighborhoods where homes, jobs, and amenities are all built efficiently, cohesively, and thoughtfully. Through comprehensive planning, we work to design and preserve environments from urban, suburban, and rural that are responsive to the needs and desires of residents. Throughout Minnesota, residents deserve the opportunity to live in a community that meets their needs and desires. We as planners also recognize that individuals and businesses make decisions based on the stability and transparency that good planning provides. Comprehensive plans through their design capture a wide range of community sentiment for the future through many hours and months of resident participation. At their end, they are not mandates or formal development proposals, but rather a community-led vision designed to be flexible and responsive to changing conditions. Comprehensive plans allow for collective community decisions which take into account for the environment, because local planning can strive to lessen emissions and congestion from transportation, reduce impervious surfaces, and protect natural landscapes and farmland from sprawl. Unlike other states, Minnesota does not have a smart growth boundary, which is utilized to protect agriculture and natural resources from development. Instead, every 10 years, municipalities in the 7-county metro are required by the Metropolitan Land Planning Act to engage in comprehensive planning efforts. State statute requires that these plans must account for population growth in a sustainable way to prevent sprawl and protect the environment. These plans are then reviewed by the environmental experts at the Metropolitan Council before being approved. Unfortunately, comprehensive plans were not mentioned in the Minnesota Environmental Rights Act, and this absence has led to a legal precedent whereby any community in the metro region may now be forced to do a costly and lengthy formal environmental review of their mandatory comprehensive plan should just one aggrieved resident demand that they do so. Thank you so much. I just want to wrap up by saying that this change to MIRA doesn't prevent cities from being held accountable. If they wanted to, it is just an ability for residential density to be not the only decision. Thank you.
Katie Cashman, Minneapolis City Council member. Sorry. Becca Ahrens, Minneapolis resident environmental advocate, and then Katie Cashman, Minneapolis City Council member. Sorry. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair, and thank you, committee. My name is Rebecca Ahrens. I am a longtime resident of Minneapolis. I'm a professional musician and environmentalist. I studied in environmental studies in college, and it's been near and dear to my heart ever since. I want to read you from the 1973 Minnesota Declaration of State Environmental Policy. The legislature recognizes the profound impact of human activity on the interrelations of all components of our natural environment, particularly profound influences of population growth and high-density urbanization. This bill states increased residential density in a comprehensive plan does not constitute that or conduct that causes or is likely to cause pollution, impairment, or destruction. Those two things are in complete opposition. I don't understand how they both can be true. I'm here to speak in opposition to this bill. I had a prepared statement, but I just have to speak from the heart here to say that I'm very disappointed that our environmental suit was actually characterized as a weaponization of the law, which is completely false. We asked the city of Minneapolis to incorporate environmental review in their planning process. We took every means necessary to do that, and we were rebuffed, and the lawsuit was a last resort. Under MIRA, the Supreme Court unanimously said that we use the law appropriately and as it was intended, and I ask you not to weaken that very, very important bedrock environmental law. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Katie Cashman, Minneapolis City Council member. And then Tim Kane, land use attorney and Minneapolis resident.
Good afternoon, Chair Hansen and members of the committee. My name is Katie Cashman, and I'm a Minneapolis City Council member representing the 7th Ward. I am here today to testify in support of House File 4028, which clarifies that comprehensive plans are not required to go through environmental review under the Minnesota Environmental Rights Act, or MIRA. And I'd like to thank Representative Jordan for bringing forward this legislation. Comprehensive plans are a policy document that set a vision to guide decision-making at the local level. In fact, comprehensive plans are in and of themselves a form of environmental review, which evaluates how projected growth will be accommodated in a way that doesn't harm existing infrastructure and environmental systems, including water resources, tree canopies, and greenscapes. It does not confer approval of any particular project or development or guarantee that any particular development pattern will occur, nor is it intended to predict how real estate and development markets will change over time. A comprehensive plan is followed by other governmental or market-driven actions, at which point effective environmental review can occur on a project-by-project basis. The language in House File 4028 would clarify any ambiguity that may exist to ensure that local governments can continue this valuable planning process without the potential for requirements that would be onerous, inappropriate, and impractical without any resulting benefit to the planning process or the environment. Cities of all sizes across the 7-county metro complete comp plans, and many find it to be a challenge for their staff and financial resources. But this kind of planning and coordination brings great benefit to the region and to the state. We would like the process to remain as effective and efficient as possible for the benefit of local communities as well as the entire region. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you. Tim Kane, land use attorney and Minneapolis resident. And then next up, Craig Johnson, League of Minnesota Cities. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tim Keene. I'm a lifetime Minneapolis resident, former city planner, land use attorney, and city attorney throughout the metropolitan area. Much has been said about the consistency of the Minneapolis 24 plan amendments with the Metropolitan Council system statements. Those system statements forecast 15,000 dwelling units in the 2040 time period. The 2040 plan provides for, as a matter of right, 150,000 dwelling units in that same planning time frame. As former Minneapolis Planning Director Perry Thorvig wrote in the Minneapolis Tribune on March 10th, the Met Council should have rejected this plan as a matter of law for its failure to conform to the consistency of the Metropolitan Statement. This plan amendment, or this statutory amendment, does not have its origins in sound policy, environmental stewardship, or empirical analysis. Rather, it's a retroactive law that is an amendment that's a desperate effort by the City of Minneapolis to do an end run on the Minnesota Supreme Court's unanimous ruling that the city must consider the environmental consequences of this massive change in land use policy. Minnesota Environmental Rights Act is a landmark law that has served the state of Minnesota well for over 50 years. Carving up MIRA in this fashion is bad policy and sets a dangerous precedent. We respectfully request that you reject Amendment 4028. Thank you.
Craig Johnson, League of Minnesota Cities, then David Hartwell, environmental activist and Minneapolis resident. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Craig Johnson with the League of Minnesota Cities. Appreciate the opportunity to make some brief comments in support of this legislation. You've already heard some of the background on this. I'm not going to repeat any of that, but I want to point out that this is a very important issue for cities because comp planning is how we set the stage through a very thorough community development process for what direction we hope our communities will move in the future. They are not project specific. They do not have the details in them that one would expect to do environmental review on. That is a process that happens when a specific project comes up. So if you have a new area that's being developed that disturbs more than an acre of land, if you have a new transit station that's being built, something like that, environmental review happens when we know what the project will be, what the type of construction will be, and exactly where it will be, so we know what natural resources might be impacted by it. Comp planning is not the right place for environmental review to happen. And unfortunately, what would happen under a future where comp plans can be legally challenged by anyone at any point is we would just stop being able to have thorough planning because it would expose us to having to do environmental review that would be nearly impossible to complete on huge swaths of our community. So we do ask that you support this. Dealing with the housing density portions of comp plans is an important step, and we hope that we can make sure this doesn't become a problem with other areas of comp plans. Last comment, Mr. Chair, just so people know, is that this legislation is related to the Metropolitan Land Planning Act, so it only affects the metropolitan area right now. And I think that's an important clarification to make on the scope of the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
David Hartwell, environmental activist and Minneapolis resident, and then Kennedy Pounds, North Minneapolis resident and environmental advocate.
Chair and members, thank you. My name is David Hartwell. I'm here to ask you not to approve this bill. I've been involved in this unfortunate lawsuit for 5 years. It's because the city of Minneapolis wants to drastically increase density, not just increase density. We're talking 150,000 housing units. And just to set the record straight, environmental review happens when you have a development of 1,000 units. It doesn't happen on a neighborhood basis. The city of Minneapolis has refused to look at the environmental consequences. No one's against density. We need more housing. The question is, where do you do it and how do you mitigate the effects of it, which is what an environmental review would do. We live in a community with impaired lakes. You'd think you'd want to know how you avoid additional pollution into those lakes. We live in a community that has a heat island index. What are you going to do to offset that as part of your comp plan, not increase the cost of heating and cooling in the city? The fact that the city has refused to discuss this or consider environmental consequences is frightening to me as a resident of the city, because I know long term, if they go through with this development and drastically increase density without any thought to where and how, we will be facing cleanup costs and mitigation costs in the future that there's no funding for. We have no plan to increase transit, but we're going to increase density. How are you going to increase density and not have transit as part of it? That's not part of their plan. So there's so many reasons why this does not make sense, including the right of citizens to say to the city, what are you doing? Why aren't you considering environmental consequences? And let me tell you, this is not for the faint of heart. This thing has cost almost $1 million in legal fees. Nobody just decides they want to spend that kind of money. So I urge you not to support this bill.
Kennedy Pounds, North Minneapolis resident and environmental advocate.
Good afternoon, Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. My name is Kennedy Pounds, and I'm a Minneapolis resident and a recent graduate of the University of Minnesota with a degree in political science. I'm also a fellow through EJCC, Environmental Justice Coordinating Council. Through EJCC, we amplify the voices of communities of color and low-income communities on matters of environmental justice issues and racial justice issues. We educate the public regarding reducing our carbon footprint, reducing air pollution, climate change resilience, flooding, heat zones, and the role of municipalities in being more responsive to the general public when making decisions that will have environmental impacts upon our community, such as the Herc incinerator in North Minneapolis. I'm also on the South Sode Green Zone Council, which raises awareness regarding environmental issues and the need for government officials to be responsive to communities. I'm here to speak in opposition to Bill House File 4028. I'm deeply disappointed by the actions of the City of Minneapolis in abusing the legislative process to silence the voices of the people who have concerns about the environmental harms that will occur as a result of the Minneapolis 2040 plan, as opposed to doing right by its citizens and conducting a long overdue environmental impact assessment of the 2040 plan. Although the city initially tried to pitch the Minneapolis 2040 plan as an equity plan, it has done little to no engagement with the Black community or other communities of color regarding environmental justice issues or the high likelihood of the impacts of gentrification on communities of color. Government has the power. MIRA is the only check on almost unfettered governmental power. This bill, by weakening MIRA, takes away the rights of over half of Minnesotans to counter this power. MIRA is a law that has been in place for 53 years, and it gives private citizens the right to sue local governments, such as the City of Minneapolis, when they fail to follow environmental laws and choose to put profits over people. Since its adoption in 1971, MIRA has never been weaponized and isn't being weaponized now. Rather, it has served as the only mechanism to provide checks and balances for citizens to use their voices to hold governments accountable for their actions. Many of us agree that more density is a good thing. I especially understand that it can be important for addressing climate change. However, it should not come at the expense of protecting our health, environment, safety, and the quality of life of those most at risk of environmental harms and impacts, including children, elders, and those with compromised immune systems. I'm hopeful that this committee will keep the powerful accountability tool that MIRA provides to private citizens to keep governments honest and accountable for their actions and for mitigating harms to the environment. We don't have to choose between more density and the environment. We can do both, and we can do better. Thus, I urge you to vote no on House File 4028. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify for or against this bill? And anyone in the audience? Members, any questions? I actually have a question. So listening to all the testimony, I'm looking at House File 4028. And it seems that Section 1 is defining a development guide. Is that correct, Representative Jordan?
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
And I'm looking for the changes to MIRA. So it would appear, and maybe I'm misunderstanding, but the objectionable part that people have got concerns on is lines 2.19 to 2.25. Is that what people are concerned about, or is it something else?
Well, Mr. Chair, I heard a lot of concern about a bill that was introduced last year and is not the bill before you, but I do think that that is probably the bill that testifiers are attempting to comment on.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Jordan, for bringing this bill forward. And just to start on my comments, I think that, you know, I will ask for all of us to not assign motives to each other. I think that the author, characterizing this as weaponization doesn't help, but I think for testifiers, this is not a product of the City of Minneapolis coming to us. This is a product of Chair Representative Jordan working with community groups who come to. And so I will hope that you don't characterize this as a desperate attempt from the city to get legislative support. And I think, you know, just to maybe elaborate more on the chair's question or point, and talking to a nonpartisan staff, and I don't think Mr. Eloff is here, and I'll ask Ms. Taylor to the extent that you can. My understanding is that, you know, with this, with the language that we have before us, this doesn't stop any
body from challenging any particular projects under MIRA. This is just going towards the plan. Is that correct?
Ms. Taylor?
Mr. Chair and members, this language would not prohibit anybody from challenging a particular project. It's just exempting the planning and other
official.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Taylor. I just want to make that clear for the record, too, that, you know, this doesn't stop any particular projects, you know, or it's, you know, exempting the plan. But, you know, if there are concerns that they could still challenge under MIRA for that piece. And, you know, just turning to the EJ piece, I really appreciate hearing from two of my residents here, too. And I think, you know, for me and my time over here, having, you know, stand up to fight for environmental justice, I think that if we were to look at the Minneapolis plan in general, you know, they do point to a policy piece around environmental justice and making sure that residents in the north side and the south side green zones are consulted when they're, you know, working towards, you know, developing their policies of our environmental justice. And I think that as chair, you know, the Capital Investment Committee, we are looking forward to how can we make more investment into, you know, communities like ours on the north side, whether that's relating to transit, to tree planting, or, you know, remediations of locations and lands that, you know, were past harms to our residents. And, you know, I think, you know, to some of the concerns that were raised, I think this is also to implore the city of Minneapolis. We have a council member here and the MAC Council to really look at this plan. And, you know, I believe that this is a plan that could be amended. And for our, you know, council members, you know, at the city, the mayor, and the MAC Council to, you know, hear out, you know, those residents, especially those that are in my district that have raised concerns about not being consulted. And I think this is an issue that should be dealt with at the local level. And, you know, for us and what we're doing here, I really just want to say thank you to everybody that has been here. And I think that, you know, this is something that hopefully our council members will do their part to hear out the residents of the city of Minneapolis. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lidzegard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as a ranger, you know, mind your own business. It seems like it's more of a issue down here, and let you guys fight it out. If you guys want to build homes, where there's lots of places to build up north, and we would welcome you to come up there. But I would like Jack Perry to come back up, Mr. Chair, and finish his suggestion. He wasn't able to, and I was curious what that was. But again, we would love for you to build homes up north.
Mr. Perry. Yeah, Mr. Perry.
What are the rules?
You got a minute. 1 minute.
Mr. Chair, Jack Perry from the Taft Law Firm. I was here before, and there's a question, I think.
Representative Liz, the guy.
Yeah, and I'm sorry. What? I was harking back, this may be a bad analogy, Mr. Representative, but back in 1989, there was a huge issue with swine producers, and swine was a topic earlier. And so they're trying to figure out how do you deal with the smell? And up, you know, I forget where it was, I think it was southern Minnesota. But the solution was, let's not try to fix it, the legislature, let's first study what the heck's going on and what we can do. And they did a 2 or 3 year generic EIS. And it was for all swine facilities, and then they came up with the rules afterwards. So it was like a 3 or 4 year process, it was 2-step, which is what we think is the ideal solution here. We have an issue with density. We in the cities, we want to have increased density. We want to do it the right way. And so the solution that keeps coming back in my mind is let's use the court-ordered EIS for the city of Minneapolis of a massive, it's not just a plan to do something, it's an authorization for 150,000 new homes that no one can ever stop. So it's a big deal. It's not a normal comprehensive plan. But we could study that, use that, have the EQB do that analysis. Takes a year and a half, just like they did in Seattle. And then we can come back and figure out, well, what do we do about this? And what are the real impacts? And, you know, are we wrong? We think there's serious environmental impacts, but the EIS will determine that. And so I just think if we're a little premature because everyone's excited about density, and that's a good thing, but I didn't think we're just a little premature in my view.
Lidzegard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We got clean water and lots of places to build. Come up north.
Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this question might go along with the previous question. It has been really interesting listening to the testimony today. I just want to thank everybody that shared their feelings on this bill. It sounds like this issue has been going on for a long time. So I just can't help but wonder, why didn't Minneapolis just do the environmental review and spending a bunch of money on litigation?
Representative Gordon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Ms. Bean would be well suited to do that as a planner. But the short answer of it is that the environmental review that folks are asking for is inappropriate for evaluating comprehensive plans. It's appropriate for evaluating individual projects. It's appropriate for evaluating a strip mall or a project at X intersection. It's not appropriate for examining a broad vision plan that doesn't say, we need to build this here. But perhaps the Planning Association could enlighten us more into those details.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Jordan, members of the committee. One thing that I think is helpful, perhaps for folks who are not familiar, is the distinction between the different types of environmental review. So Moorhead was brought up as an example many times, which utilized an AUAR, or an area-wide urban review. That still has some degree of project understanding. So you understand what might get built to be able to make that review. An EAW, or an environmental assessment worksheet, is often done for projects that might need an EIS, or an environmental impact statement. So those are short form worksheets that are done, again, when you have a specific project in mind. So for example, I work for a community. We have a 15-story tower being built. That EAW process is part of the development to just ensure that, does this need further environmental review? If it doesn't, you're done with environmental review at that point, because it complies with other local or MPCA regulations. An EIS is a very, very big form environmental impact. And so that is something that we use for light rail or for the stadium downtown. They're for huge projects. And so I think sometimes that distinction of like, well, this is a huge project, let's use an EIS, sometimes makes sense. But in both of those examples, like the light rail development or the Viking Stadium, they are real projects. And comprehensive plans are not real projects. They're visions. They're meant to guide the idea of development, what it might look like if it happens, but they're flexible. They're not mandates. They don't require development happen. They are just what the community imagines, what their street or neighborhood might look like someday. As a project happens, then again, those EISs or EAWs happen when a real formulated project with actual specifications exists. And so that's the challenge with doing a comprehensive plans. Now, comprehensive plans in of themselves include stormwater, wastewater, tree canopy. Every plan is slightly different depending on how, you know, much a community wants to put into a comprehensive plan. But they're also developed on a decade of planning by the Met Council prior to a community starting that plan. So right now, the Met Council is working on what they imagine cities will need to know for 2050. And all of that data, a lot of it environmental, is part of a comprehensive plan and is used to develop comprehensive plans.
Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm going to refer back to previous testimony just to finish this out. I thought I heard that a generic EIS or something like that, whatever type might work best, maybe would be more in line with avoiding litigation. Is there anything you might want to add to that?
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the testifier could speak. I'm not familiar with this bill from 1999 when I was in elementary school, but perhaps a generic EIS or whatever would be something that Ms. Bean would be able to refer to.
Thank you, Representative Jordan and Chair Hansen. There is no generic EIS. An EIS requires project detail. And so that is the challenge of an environmental impact study, is it requires a significant amount of detail. Again, like the light rail or the Viking Stadium, it requires you to know something about the project, which makes it hard to do in this process where we generally know we want to add density, but we don't know what those homes look like, how big they will be, how many actual exact units they will end up being. And so there's no way to measure it, and that is what we assert as the Planning Association is very challenging about this this ask of cities is that for a city of Minneapolis, they can make guesses. And I think that that's what would end up happening in this scenario. But I implore you to think about smaller communities, communities like the city of Larpinder or Falcon Heights, or little cities that have very small tax capacities. And to do this and to make these types of guesses are likely to be wrong and also very expensive and hard to do.
Before you go, Representative, just to correct, we do have a history in the state of generic environmental impact statements. We did one for forestry, and I think we did one on feedlots. And so there is, just to make sure the record is correct. Representative Heisman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was simply going to cite the MPCA webpage and point out that exact point. So thank you for making it for me.
Any other questions, members? Representative Jordan, would you like to renew your motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair, but before I do that, I want members and I want the public to know that this is among the more personal bills that I've carried here. I mean, I think they're all personal in their own way, but I am a resident of a fourplex, and I think it's unfortunate in many ways that the way for people in our state and in our country to achieve upward mobility and have stability in their residency is that they have to own a home. The only way that I was able to own a home is because I was able to purchase a unit in a fourplex. And I believe in density. I think this is what our environment is calling for. We need to make sure that we're stopping sprawl. We're losing valuable farmland in Representative Purcell's area because people can't afford to live in my district. I hear from people who are crying, literally crying on the phone, talking to me about their lack of affordability in Northeast Minneapolis, which is known for many years as a very affordable place to grow. And for a lot of people, it's where we have this concept of a starter home. The starter home doesn't exist anymore. It doesn't. People are not able to start their lives. And if we don't do something about it, it's going to get harder and harder. I also represent an area where there have been people who have had to live in encampments, in tents, and that's not right. And if we continue to do nothing, there's going to be more and more people who are going to face that housing insecurity. Many of you have also heard about how I've really struggled with asthma. You know, my asthma has gotten worse, and now I have to have another inhaler. And that inhaler with our state insurance cost me $60 a month in addition to my other inhaler. So it's about $2 a puff. I have our state insurance, which is really good, but many of my constituents don't. And I hear from them as well. And as you heard today, the number one thing that is giving them asthma and is that hurting their ability to live their lives with dignity and respect is that they have asthma, and it's cars. It is single occupancy vehicles that are going through our neighborhoods. And it's not people's fault that they have to drive through our neighborhoods. It is patterns of development and patterns of locating highways in areas and where people are forced to move as farther and farther away. And so it's not those people's fault. This isn't an anti-person bill. This is a pro-person bill, and this is a way for us to celebrate and make sure that people in Minnesota can live their lives healthily and live their lives in a way that they want to. This is a bill that's good for the environment, and it's good for people. You know, this is, and so I will be honest, like, yes, this is a bill that I cared very deeply about. And if I do apologize for words that might have been disrespectful to individuals, that it's not my intention, but I recognize that words have power. I think none understand that words have power is why we're all here. But this bill matters, and for people to say that this bill doesn't matter is important, and we need to make sure that we're doing about this and applying what is appropriate to our environmental review and making sure that what we're doing is appropriate and can strengthen our environment and strengthen our communities. And so I do ask for member support to get this to the state government committee, and I renew my motion that House File 4028 be re-referred to the state government committee.
Representative Jordan renews her motion, House File 4028. Be re-referred to the State and Local Government Finance and Policy Committee. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, say no. Ayes have it, and the motion is adopted. Next up is the Lands Bill, House File 3508.
The land bill. Next on our bill is our lands bill, House File 3508. Representative Hansen, would you like to move the bill?
Yes, I would move House File 3508 be referred to the Ways and Means Committee.
And Representative Hansen, I believe you have an A2 author's amendment. Would you like to move your amendment and explain it briefly?
Yes, I would move the A2 author's amendment. Members, Mr. Strohmeyer sent out to all members if they had additional lands bill provisions. A number of members on both sides of the aisle, as happens every year, have some proposals. So we have consolidated those into the amendment. I would implore if anybody has any others, it would be timely before Ways and Means to get that to us. And we did check that with the minority, too, to make sure we've got everything. And capable DNR staff here who will walk us through the lands bill. So I would move the A2 amendment to get everything in that we know of relating to lands proposals at this time.
Representative Hansen moves the A2 amendment to get the bill in the form he would like. Did someone say, wait a minute? Oh. I'm going to start over. Representative Hansen moves the A2 amendment to get the bill in the form the author wants. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, say no. The motion prevails. The A2 amendment is adopted. Representative Hansen, to your bill as amended.
And I have with me Lori Klein with the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources for the annual walkthrough of the lands bill.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Klein. Please state your name and title for the record, and then help us with the walkthrough and any explanation needed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee members, good afternoon. My name is Lori Klein. I'm an attorney for the DNR in the Division of Lands and Minerals. I'll be walking you through the 2024 Lands Bill today. Each year, the Lands Bill typically includes amendments to statutes affecting DNR-administered state land or DNR's land transactions, changes to state park or state forest boundaries, and authorization to sell certain lands. DNR coordinates statutory and program requirements to sell land that no longer meets conservation or recreation needs or that are isolated from larger management areas. Section 1 of the bill seeks to amend Minnesota Statute 85015 Subdivision 1B. That section requires a landowner with a pre-existing right of access over a trail right-of-way. It requires that landowner to pay a $2,000 application fee when requesting a written easement from the DNR. This proposed change would allow the DNR to assume and cover that application fee when the DNR's land management interests benefit from issuance of the easement. Section 2 amends Minnesota Statute 94343, Subdivision 8A, which applies to exchanges of Class A land. Currently, that subdivision grants the DNR authority to charge fees of not less than one half of the cost for determining value and survey. This proposal adds additional types of fees to that list, including for legal and professional fees, cost of title work, advertising and public hearings, transactional staff costs, and closing costs. Section 3 amends Minnesota Statute 94-3495, which governs expedited exchanges. This statute does not currently authorize the DNR to charge fees to the other party in an expedited exchange. This proposal will authorize the DNR to charge one half of the costs for the same categories of fees that I just discussed in Section 2. The bill also proposes additions to three state park boundaries. Section 4, Subdivision 1, adds approximately 40 acres to Banning State Park. This is already state-owned and state-administered land and is adjacent to the park. Section 4, Subdivision 2 adds approximately 120 acres to Father Hennepin State Park to facilitate a possible future acquisition of the land. Section 4, Subdivision 3 adds approximately 20 acres to Lake Louise State Park to facilitate a possible future acquisition of the land. Sections 5 and 11 of this bill achieve technical consistency with 2023 legislation directing the transfer of land in the Upper Sioux Agency State Park by abolishing the park and removing the park from the list of statutory state parks in Minnesota Statute 85012. In addition, Sections 5 and 11 abolish and remove the Hill Annex Mine State Park from this list to allow for active iron ore mining at the site. Sections 6 through 10 authorize the commissioner to sell certain lands. The DNR already has authority to sell some lands, but these require legislative authorization because the lands will be sold by private sale rather than by auction, or because they bought quarter public waters, or because they will be sold for less than market value, or some combination of those factors. I have a short explanation on each of the proposed sales. If you would like me to provide those, please let me know. Section 6 authorizes the public sale of approximately 12 acres of riparian land in Chisago County, together with a channel construction maintenance easement and an access easement. I do want to note that on the maps that the DNR provided, the map for this Section 6 does display the access easement. However, it does not show the channel easement. The channel easement would be a area off of the east side of the property, and we can provide an updated map if desired. Section 7 and 8 authorize the conveyance of an approximate 2.9-acre parcel in Hubbard County. Section 7 would authorize 2.5 acres of that parcel to be conveyed to the county for no consideration, with DNR retaining a trail easement over a portion of that. The bill will also authorize DNR to convey approximately 0.3 acres of the same parcel to two adjacent landowners to resolve encroachment issues. Section 9 authorizes the conveyance of approximately 20 acres in Redwood County to a federally recognized Indian tribe for no consideration. And Section 10 authorizes the private sale of approximately 15.1 acres of land in Roseau County to a watershed district. DNR also reviewed the A2 amendment, and we have no objection to the addition of those parcels. And that concludes my comments. Thank you for your time today. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify for or against this bill? We'll go to questions from members. Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Hansen, I just want to thank you for addressing a few of the minority's concerns, and we'll be working with you on offline to hopefully resolve those.
Additional questions or comments from members? Otherwise, Representative Hansen, any closing comments?
This is the annual lands bill. We're sending it to Ways and Means. I'd ask for your support.
Representative Hansen renews his motion that House File 3508, as amended, be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, say no. The motion prevails. The last bill of the day is House File 4320. And Representative Hansen, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd move House File 4320 and to be laid over for possible inclusion in a future bill. This is an agency bill, and I have with me the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, Dana Vanderbosch, to talk about the bill.
Yes.
Good afternoon.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the title, or please state your name and title and proceed.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Dana Vanderbosch. I am the Assistant Commissioner for Water Policy and Agriculture here at the MPCA. And I'd like to thank you for this opportunity to speak in support of House File 4320, and also thank Chair Hansen for carrying the bill for us. This proposal seeks to align guidance between the groundwater protection rule that the Minnesota Department of Agriculture oversees and the feedlot statutes that the MPCA implements to ensure a coordinated approach between the MDA and the MPCA for total nitrogen management in areas that are most vulnerable to groundwater contamination. The groundwater protection rule pertains to drinking water supply management areas which have elevated nitrate and where the drinking water supply for the area is threatened. And the goal is to take action to reduce nitrate in groundwater before a public well exceeds the nitrate water quality standard that's been set to protect drinking water. In drinking water supply management areas where nitrate is high, the MDA evaluates the total nitrogen rate used on cropland in the drinking water supply management area boundary, and they include both the commercial fertilizer and manure in their calculations, and then they publish and promote a nitrogen fertilizer rate. They do this work in concert with an advisory team comprised of farmers that are located within the drinking water supply management area. Under current rules, fields receiving manure within a drinking water supply management area may have two recommended total nitrogen rates, one that's established by the MDA's published nitrogen rate for the drinking water supply management area, and then a second one that is established within a manure management plan. And so this policy proposal is really seeking to align the two nitrogen rate recommendations, ensuring protection of groundwater. Farmers applying manure within this area would need to use the Department of Agriculture's published nitrogen rate for the drinking water supply management area, and they'd need to submit a manure management plan to the MPCA for approval. And then our approval would ensure that the farmer understands that the Department of Ag is working within that particular area to protect drinking water supply, and that the farmer is planning on applying manure nitrogen at the rates that the Department of Agriculture is setting for the drinking water supply area. This approach would apply to about 0.5 to 1% of the cropland in Minnesota, so it's a very small area relative to all cropland. And so this is really a very targeted approach, and it's really directly related to the need to actively work with landowners in these drinking water supply management areas with high nitrate levels in groundwater to reduce that pollutant and safeguard people's drinking water. We brought this proposal to agricultural stakeholders and environmental advocates for discussion, and we all believe that the goal of aligning these two programs to avoid confusion for farmers and also to ensure groundwater protection is something that we can all agree to, and that this proposal offers a reasonable and focused approach to help reduce nitrate in these sensitive areas. So we have a representative from the Department of Agriculture here today to speak to the groundwater protection rule and the way that they manage their program if you have any questions on that front. And so we're happy to answer any questions you might have.
Next on my list for testimony is Shea Lynn Ramson from the Land Stewardship Project and Goodhue County Livestock Farmer. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record, your title, and proceed.
Hi, my name is Shaylin Rampin. I am on the Land Stewardship Project Animal Agriculture Steering Committee. Thank you for having me today. Animal agriculture with the right systems and policies can be a solution to the compounding challenges our communities face: unsafe drinking water, changing climate, soil erosion, and a loss of soil organic matter, and more. On our small cattle crop farm in Goodhue County, we use a variety of practices, including managed grazing, no-till, cover crop, and buffer strips to help protect our water and land. Although we have not had our personal well tested, we know neighbors that do have contaminated wells. While the Land Stewardship Project appreciates this bill and supports it, requiring manure management plans and a level two duisma alone will not make significant differences in addressing water quality issues across the state, such as the nitrate crisis in southeast Minnesota. We must go further to reduce the over-application of nitrate fertilizing manure and manure, including passing Representative Smith's HF 4630, which would reform manure management more holistically, and significantly expanding the adoption of effective soil health practices that reduce the needs for input. We hope that you pass House File 4320 in conjunction with taking additional actions to ensure all Minnesotans can drink safely from their tap, regardless of their zip code. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify on this bill? Representative Jacob.
Thank you, Chair Jordan. So a couple of these duismas are in my district, and I'm just wondering, some of my counties have feedlot officers and some of them do not. So can you just explain to me the process between a county that has a feedlot officer and one that does not have a feedlot officer, the employment of the program?
Representative Hansen.
I would ask for the PCA to come down to describe the differences between those counties that have and those that have delegated authority.
Assistant Commissioner Vanderbosch.
Madam Chair, committee members. We work with a variety of different, we work with all of the different counties, but as you know, in some counties, the responsibility to manage the feedlot rules is delegated down to counties. And so those counties take over the work of working with farmers that are registered within the particular county that we're we're talking about, and they conduct inspections and other kinds of regulatory activities there.
Representative Jacob.
I'm well aware of that.
I'm not sure.
But I'm wondering, what's the difference in process between my counties that have a feedlot officer and the counties that I have in my district that do not have a feedlot officer?
Assistant Commissioner Vanderbosch.
Madam Chair, Representative, are you talking about relative to this bill and how it would function?
Representative Jacob.
Thank you for that clarification.
Yes.
Assistant Commissioner Vanderbosch.
Madam Chair, Representative. So in these areas, I might need some help here from the Department of Ag, but in these drinking water supply management areas where there's elevated nitrate and where, you know, what this bill is proposing would be enacted, the Department of Ag will be working with the farmers already. They'll be reaching out to all the farmers within these drinking water supply management areas and inviting them to participate in the activities that the Department of Ag is going to be managing. And so those county feedlot officers would be part and parcel of the entities that would be alerted to the Department of Ag's work, and they would presumably be on the advisory team. So when it comes to farmers needing to complete a manure management plan and submit it for approval, they would, if they're in a county that has a county feedlot officer, they would be working with that county feedlot officer. If it is not a delegated county, then they would be working with the PCA. And so I think it would be a joint effort, and I think it is just, it depends based on the drinking water supply management area that we're talking about. I don't know if the Department of Ag,
Would the Department of Ag like to testify on this? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and title, and please try to answer Representative Jacob's question.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Margaret Wagner. I manage the fertilizer non-point section at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. I do not have much to add to your question. I think that the clarification there is that the process to work with a delegated authority for a manure management plan or directly with the agency would not change under this bill. In those counties where there is delegated authority, we engage them through a local advisory process, and they're part of that process as we talk about local practices and groundwater protection.
Representative Jacob?
Yes, just one last follow-up question. And so my understanding is that when you talk about an advisory committee, that these feedlot officers would be able to give input on what really functions the best in the counties, for the counties that have feedlot officers.
Yeah. Ms. Wagner?
Very well.
Madam Chair. Members, that's correct, yeah. And we have examples of that in other areas of the state where we do have that delegated authority as part of our team and advising us as we come up, as the commissioner comes up with a list of published best management practices for the area.
Any other questions from members? Otherwise, Representative Hansen, any closing comments?
That's a good plug for county feedlot operators and to have a delegated authority to have that local involvement. I would renew my motion that House File 4320 be re-referred or be laid over for possible inclusion in a future bill.
Representative Hansen renews his motion that House File 4320 be laid over for possible inclusion in a future bill. Bill was laid over. And members, with that, we are adjourned.